We be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Let us begin our worship this morning in song. In the center of our service and in the center of our lives, let us pause to honor the silences of our world. Let us open our minds and our hearts to a place of quiet, to the silent prayer for the healing of pain and the soft, gentle coming of love. Please feel free to light a candle of memory and hope if you are so moved. Spirit of life and love, be in our hearts and our minds this hour. Let us be at peace with our bodies and our minds. Let us return to ourselves and become wholly ourselves. Let us be aware of the sources of being common to us all and to all living things. Evoking the presence of the great compassion, let us fill our hearts with our own compassion towards ourselves and towards all living beings. And let us pray that we ourselves cease to be the cause of suffering to each other. With humility, with awareness of the existence of life and of the sufferings that are going on around us, let us practice the establishment of peace in our hearts and on the earth. Amen. I thought I'd give his stool a try this morning. I want to talk to you a little bit about my recent trip to Nicaragua last month. I traveled to Nicaragua with the Faithful Fools Street Ministry of San Francisco. The Fools have been an important part of my life since my first semester of seminary. They have a philosophy of abundance that's affirmed by picking up pennies as they walk the streets of the Tenderloin District of San Francisco. This came about because one day when Kay was on her way to pick up some lunch, something hit her on the arm, and she looked up the top of the subway, and there was a man pointing down to the ground. And she looked down, and there were two pennies on the ground. She picked them up and put them in her pocket and went on her way to the delicatessen. And when she got in the store, a man came up to her holding a cup of coffee. And he said, "Ma'am, would you happen to have 2 cents? If I had 2 cents, I could buy this cup of coffee." So she gave him the 2 cents from her pocket. And she thought, "We have what is needed before it is asked of us." So this brings up the idea of vocation or calling. I mean the fact that most of us are looking for what we are supposed to be doing with our lives. We have gifts and the world has needs, and we want to find a way to serve the world while fulfilling our own sense of meaning and purpose. For me, it's been kind of like somewhere over the rainbow. I'm always seeking, and I'm always searching. I had to go all the way to Nicaragua to find out what had been with me all along. If I only had a brain. Kind of like the pennies, you know. We have what is needed before it is asked. I'm still reeling from the 10 days of witnessing the desperate situation of the people of Nicaragua. Over 80% of the population live below the UN poverty line. We're living in a world where many of the dangers we face are of our own making. Nuclear weapons pose a very real threat, but a more hideous and insidious reality is the ever-present injustice of our new global economy. This is what I witnessed in Nicaragua, the perils of our own making, man's interference with the environment, cultural pollution, political corruption, the exploitation of a desperate, therefore cheap labor force, and the aftermath of a bloody revolution. 34,000 children die every day in this world, a world where there are enough resources for everyone to have basic needs. Why is that? Someone once said, "When I bring food to the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist." What is it about our present economic system that creates this kind of paradox? What's missing in our new global economy is a global vision with human rights objectives of basic needs for everyone. So with this paradox in mind, I want to share with you some of what I learned in my 10 days in Nicaragua. I came home with more questions than answers, conflicted about my path in ministry. How can I be an effective minister? Where will my gifts do the most good? I have to be totally honest with you, I came home with a deep despair. The people of Nicaragua believe that their situation is hopeless, yet they persevere with dignity. But a heaviness weighs in my heart. But in the midst of that despair, somewhere resides a seed of hope. Before going to the barrio, where we lived with families for 4 days, the first morning in Nicaragua, we went to the Global Education Center for a class. And I'd like to share with you an abbreviated version of what I learned about the history of Nicaragua. The United States has been involved in Nicaragua since the early 1900s. In 1909, the United States supported a revolution that restored conservative rule. Uprisings led to the United States military intervention in 1912, and the United States Marines remained in Nicaragua until 1925 and then returned again in 1926. They replaced the existing armies with a United States-trained National Guard. They supervised 2 presidential elections. Their presence was opposed by General Augusto Cesar Sandino, who organized an army that they called the Small Mad Army. Sandino conducted guerrilla war with the Marines until they finally departed. He agreed at a peace agreement meeting to stop all fighting, but was assassinated as he left that meeting by the National Guard, shot in the back. The Guard's commander, Somoza, seized power in 1936, inaugurating more than 40 years of rule by the Somoza family. President Roosevelt reportedly said that Somoza is an SOB, but he's our SOB. When Somoza was assassinated in 1956 by a poet activist, his sons assumed the power. Nicaragua's economy grew under the Somozas, but corruption, particularly after the 1972 earthquake, limited the benefits and produced growing resentment. The city could have been rebuilt twice with the aid that poured in from all over the world, but the National Guard confiscated most of it, and they even sold the blankets. The rubble from the earthquake in Managua was bulldozed into Lake Managua by the National Guard at the orders of Somoza, thereby polluting these waters to this very day. The United States supported Somoza until the very end. Somoza had even bombed his own people. The human rights violations were staggering. Finally, the people of Nicaragua had had enough, and they rallied around the Sandinistas. And on July 19, 1979, the dictatorship was overthrown, and the Sandinistas were in charge. Euphoria spread across Nicaragua, and Nicaragua experimented with an alternative economic model that combined capitalism and socialism. It wasn't perfect. The Sandinistas made mistakes, but the country experienced an almost complete solidarity, with the illiteracy rate being reduced in only 1 year from an average of 52% to 12.8%. The entire population was organized by asking for volunteers, 60,000 people, to teach people to read. Over 80,000 people participated. Newspapers were even published in a larger print so that the people could read them. Some people called this communism. The UN awarded Nicaragua with a medal for the effort of the literacy campaign and for their health reforms. But within less than 2 months of the overthrow of Somoza, the CIA was secretly forming a military force, later to be named the Contras. With the support of the United States, a war began, and 60% of Nicaragua's national budget went to fight that war. Under Ronald Reagan, the United States aided the Contras, based in neighboring Honduras, and exerted economic pressure, claiming that communism was just 2 marching days away from the Texas border. The World Court charged that the United States had violated international law, and they awarded Nicaragua millions of dollars to be paid by the United States. The U.S. refused to recognize the court's jurisdiction, and the court had no power to force the U.S. to comply. The Sandinistas eventually lost control of the country as the people grew weary of all the death and destruction. The past 20 years in Nicaragua, things have gone from bad to worse. The current president is now under house arrest for corruption and fraud. The vice president is in power, but the people don't have much hope that he's going to be any better or will make a difference. Meanwhile, a small percentage of people have employment in the sweatshops that are called free trade. Most people still can't afford to send their children to school. The unions are making an effort, but it's a dangerous endeavor. The IMF has threatened to cancel the loan agreement recently signed with Nicaragua because the National Assembly changed the nation's budget to give more money to the local schools. Almost 1 million children are out of school in Nicaragua today. They beg in the streets. They're at all the stoplights. They get hooked on glue sniffing because it stops their hunger. The people of Nicaragua are in survival mode. In spite of that, I saw an uncommon dignity and strength, as in the streets of San Francisco and in Austin with the homeless, a deep sense of community. They need each other. We can help the people of Nicaragua with responsible consumerism. This church is now purchasing fair trade coffee. It can be bought in Austin. I can't remember the name of the co-op. Wheatsville. I urge you to buy it because the growers of Nicaragua and in other third world countries receive 40% of the profits from that coffee if you buy fair trade. Otherwise, they just get pennies. This was the Faithful Fools' maiden voyage to Nicaragua as an educational group experience. Carmen Barsotti, a Franciscan sister and the other half of the Faithful Fools, spent over 8 years living in the barrio of Nicaragua in Managua with other nuns. The mission there was to start programs that would improve nutrition, teach life skills, and fight domestic violence. The night before I went, I was preparing to go, packing my things, trying to decide what to do, what to take, and putting the finishing touches on my newly painted red toenails, when my sister, who was watching me with amused interest, said, "Oh, great. The princess goes to Nicaragua. Aren't you concerned that you will make the people you stay with feel bad if you show up looking all flashy?" Well, big sisters have clout, you know, so I was really careful to pack very simple clothes and no makeup. Boy, was I surprised when we arrived in the barrio and all the women had not only painted toenails and fingernails, but lots of makeup. They must have thought we were slobs because by the end of 4 days, we had to wash our clothes by hand with cold water and they were filled with soap smudges and wrinkles. They even iron a crease in their blue jeans. And even with dirt floors in their homes, their shoes are spotless. I don't know how they do it. There's just so much to tell you. It's still a kaleidoscope of feelings and experiences, living in huts with dirt floors, showering with cold water, listening to roosters crow and dogs bark all night long while my host family slept like logs. The terrible poverty mixed with the wonderful laughter and happiness of these people. We weren't expecting that. We were expecting it to be sad. The conditions are tough, but they persevere. And I heard stories of men who fought and survived the revolution and of their friends that died. There was joy, dancing, artistic expression, and laughter. I found the people who have chosen a path of courageous and creative integrity. It seems to be true that no external force can destroy a people if at first it does not win the victory of the spirit against them. They went all out to welcome us when we first arrived with a festive gathering. The children were wearing handmade costumes and they performed traditional dances and music for us. My family consisted of a 37-year-old single mother with three children. Mercedes was one of the women helped by Carmen's mission work. She had been beaten and abused by her husband. But what I found was a survivor. I found myself admiring this strong, dedicated mother. She had a little store in the front of her home called a pulperia that opened at 7 a.m. in the morning and closed at 10 p.m. The children helped her run the store, and they also helped with the chores. Mercedes also had two rental rooms in the back of her home that she rented to two married couples. We all shared one bathroom. There was a sink outside with three compartments where you were to brush your teeth, wash your clothes, and wash the dishes. No one spoke English in this house, and it was exhausting not speaking their language. But fortunately, there was an 18-year-old girl across the street who had been hired to be my interpreter. She spent a lot of time with us, and after 4 days, Mercedes and I found that we had a lot in common. We shared a common bond. The first night in the barrio, it was so noisy I could hardly sleep. There's absolutely no privacy there. And I think I had just barely fallen asleep when I heard Mercedes gathering the water at 4 a.m. She got up at 4 a.m. to gather water like all the other women in the barrio. It only runs from 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. The fancy hotels in Managua have running water all day long, but not in the barrio. One afternoon, they took us to visit the dump they called the Chereca. People are living there, scavenging for food and items that they might sell or use. I was sickened by the smell and the dust, but mostly from seeing the children eating rotten potatoes, barefoot, filthy, and sad. There were cattle there with their ribs protruding, fighting with the crowds for a morsel of something to eat. They told us that the people drink the milk from those contaminated cows. You could see the gases from the decaying garbage rising and blowing around with all the dust and the filth, and we were all standing in it, breathing it in. But they were living in it. They had built makeshift shacks, and they lived in the dump. The dry, dusty, contaminated filth with broken glass everywhere. I saw only one child with shoes. We weren't welcome there. When someone saw us looking at them, they threw something at us. The man that took us in there to be sure that we were safe said that he had started a school for the children of the Chereca. He said that they learn to read and write, and it's his hope that they can get out of there. Some of them are being trained to be mechanics and hairdressers. So far, 30 have completed the program. 30. Hairdressers. I had to fight back tears when I heard that. It was life-giving. It had been life-giving for me when I was a teenage mother. Why is it that I still feel embarrassed about having been a hairdresser? I survived and thrived as a hairdresser and a single mother. It is life-giving in this seemingly hopeless situation. Suddenly, I was able to feel complete gratitude for the gift that had been given to me all those years ago. I had a bad fall in the marketplace and was taken to the hospital just to be sure my wrist, which was very swollen, wasn't broken, and my chin. The inside of the hospital was so filthy, I couldn't believe it. They have socialized medicine in Nicaragua, but the budget has cut so far back that people have to pay for all of the tests, all of their medicine, all of their x-rays. So people are dying of curable illnesses there because they can't even afford to buy food, especially the children. The next day, we drove north to the country, to the campo, to live with families in the poor community of San Diego, Nicaragua. We were welcomed once again with a festive gathering. They blindfolded us and made us bat at a piñata and laughed while we danced. We also played pin the tail on the donkey. Again, we were all just amazed at the strength of the community in this village. They needed one another. They worked together. And their way of life was simple and so primitive to us, but very resourceful. The women in this little village had learned to quilt years ago. A Mary Knoll sister had come and taught them a few simple patterns. They didn't have many resources, but they were making items to sell. If they only had a few more techniques and books, I thought how much easier their work would be and how much more creative it would be. The Peace Corps volunteer was a young woman from Hawaii, and she was teaching them to have backyard gardens. They didn't know how to grow gardens and to preserve their food by canning. The water was very scarce. The rainforests have been cut, and the last 30 years they've been experiencing drought. So they use most of their water for watering down the dirt floors to keep them from being dusty. Having owned a farm, I picked up a few skills along the way. I'm a quilter. I took the Master Gardener course, and I even became a licensed commercial food processor so I could sell my home canned goods. I was discovering once again more life-giving skills that I had been taking for granted. Simple life-giving skills that mean the difference between life and death in Nicaragua. After we left the country, we visited a school where they're rescuing the street kids, giving them a chance to get a basic education and learn a skill or craft. They teach them to make hammocks, and some are taught woodworking, and others are being trained as bakers. Once again, I owned a bakery. When I saw the bakery, I realized, too, that this was life-giving, a life-giving skill. The breads and the cakes and pastries were sold to support the school. There had been only one loaf of bread left, and I looked at it and it was flat and hard, obviously overprocessed due to the conditions. I asked the instructor, did they use chilled water to mix the dough? That would have solved the problem. And she said, no. No one has come to teach us that technology. Well, her words stayed with me. And our last day, we went to Messiah and we had reflections at a volcano. Time to write in our journal, to think, and to pray. I climbed to the top of a peak so that I could look down in the belly of the volcano. In the peripheral of my vision, I could see a large stone stairway that led to a primitive cross that had been built as a monument to the people who had died when this volcano had spewed its hot lava many years ago. I spent 2 hours sitting there thinking, but what kept coming into my thought was the chalice lighting from my seminary, Star King. Every week in chapel, we would say these words. With the kindling of this flame, I reaffirm my commitment to accept my gifts with grace and gratitude and to use them to bless the world in the spirit of love. I'd been reciting those words week after week for over 3 years, but suddenly they became crystal clear. Of course, accept my gifts and use them. I began to say that vow at the top of my voice out over the belly of that volcano, and I didn't stop saying those words the whole climb down from that mountain, 20 minutes, over and over again. When I went back to Star King to talk to my advisor, Rosemary Canici, a Franciscan sister, she said, well, you've had a conversion experience. Well, I don't know if I had a conversion experience. I don't know what it is. I looked it up and it said change. Okay, I've changed. I think what happened to me during the past month was that I think I've received a calling, or at least finally understood a calling that's been there all along. It wasn't supernatural, it was natural. And it's super because I don't have to leave parts of me behind anymore. It was as though my river is moving towards the sea, creating its own banks that contain it. But the river doesn't always move in the direction that we expect. We go to school and prepare, try to stay awake and alert to what's going on in the world. And then suddenly, we seem to collect our own needs and gifts, and we have a chance to make a difference, to use our gifts. The answers are often right in front of us, and we don't see it. There are so many ways that we can each uniquely bless the world with our gifts. As Mother Teresa was always so fond of saying, it's the small things, the little acts of love that make all the difference. Just as we tend to discard the pennies as not worth much, we also tend to discount our most important gifts because they seem small or insignificant. Gifts that can make a difference somewhere to someone. I was planning to do a year of chaplaincy next year. I was accepted last week at MD Anderson Hospital in Houston. But then, without warning or expectation, the Faithful Fools called me and invited me to spend next year working with them in San Francisco with the homeless and in Nicaragua with the rural people. Well, I didn't feel like I even had a choice. I accepted immediately without hesitation, and then I called Davidson. Davidson called it serendipity and a calling. He told me there are two events in life that stand out above most others. The first is feeling that you've received a calling, and the second is answering the calling. Serendipity doesn't mean dumb luck, he said. And then he told me the story of the brothers Serendip. Well, that sounded just as fishy and incredible as the conversion thing, so I checked it out on the internet. And sure enough, it comes from a story of the three princes of Serendip, who were always making discoveries by accident and insight of things that they were not in quest of. Well, that's serendipity, being rewarded in a way you hadn't expected for preparation you had made for another kind of endeavor. So after finishing this wonderful year with you, at the end of July, I'll be going to San Francisco to work with the homeless. And then I'll go to Nicaragua and live in a small town in the country called Esteli for 2 months, where I will learn Spanish and live with a family. Then I don't know what next. I'll continue to try and listen and respond openly and honestly. It's a leap of faith, kind of like stepping out into the abyss. We have to find grants. We have to find donations, other ways to support this work. But the fools have been finding those pennies of faith all along. So I'm just going to trust. So call it serendipity, or call it grace, or just plain coincidence. Sometimes life offers us paths that we have never expected, paths that suddenly become the path that we have been looking for all along. It's what I have wished for myself, and what I wish for you, each in your own way. Howard Thurman wrote, "Ask not what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And then go do it. Because what the world needs are people who have come alive. Another world is not only possible. She is on her way. And on a quiet day, I can hear her breathing."